Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to the Glove and Almas podcast. I am your host, of course, G Love. We are back with part two with Joseph Holcomb, one of my favorite conversations to date. We're going to pick up where we left off. I believe we talked a bit about alternative models. Now, something interesting has happened in Joe's day this morning. We're going to hear about that. Joseph, welcome back to the podcast. Let's hear about today.
Yeah, so today, actually, I saw my email. There was a five questions from the Microdose. Five questions for Zach Kamenetz. I hope I pronounced that right. I'm always bad at pronouncing things and names that I don't seem to write in. But yeah, so he's a rabbi who participated in the Johns Hopkins study of religious professionals, you know, giving them psychedelics. And he's been going around telling his story because he was someone who felt, or I'll use his own words actually here. Sure. So over the following months, like after he had joined the study, he began to question the objectivity of the, or this isn't his words, a paraphrase of another interview someone did. So he began to question the objectivity of the research protocols in the Hopkins study. Everything from the music played during the sessions to the questionnaires designed to measure and quantify something as slippery as religious experience. Psychedelics have the power to put people into vulnerable states of suggestibility. Kamenetz began to ask himself, whose experience am I having? Was it his own mystical experience or a type of revelation favored by the designers of the project, including veteran psychedelic therapist Bill Richards? And then he goes, he says, this is his words here, he says, I have grave concerns for the spiritual and cultural health and well-being of my community. Kamenetz said, what are the cultural assumptions that Bill or the team make about the meaning of my experience? Uh-huh. They were coming from a particular religious background, the perennial philosophy that it's all the same at its core. And so, you know, these concerns led Kamenetz to found SHEPA, a Jewish psychedelic support group, and organize a Jewish psychedelic summit in the spring of 2021. And then he says, to Rabbi Kamenetz, this amorphous theology expressed by many in psychedelic circles, quote, does violence to the diversity of religious lineage and traditions. So that's kind of like a backstory here of this guy who's just interviewed on the Microdose, you know, someone who felt like, wait a second, what's the, I don't know if this model that, that Hopkins is using in this study is really, you know, accommodating of everybody's diverse backgrounds and experiences, mm-hmm. you know? So kind of why, part of why I'm bringing him up is just as an example of, you know, came into my Microdose, the five questions appeared today. So it's one of those little kind of spontaneous things, I suppose. But I wanted to bring him up as just, you know, an example of one of the people out there who are paying attention to this issue of, you know, protecting people's right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, and really how different models that are used in research can, you know, as he says, you know, do violence to the diversity of religious lineages and tradition. And I also, in the Microdose interview, I saw this is really, I was really pleased to see this. He said he didn't name the researcher, but so this is an example of a, looks like some moves being made towards, to a certain extent, investigating alternative models, or at least working to respect religious diversity in a specialized way. But he says, right now, I'm speaking with a researcher interested in doing a study about rabbis and how a well-curated, safe, and supported psychedelic experience could influence rabbis' religious life. We've talked about what we have not yet seen yet in the clinical world, the experience of prolonged integration, not just one or two sessions, but up to 6 months of integration support for people. That's an exciting model, one that builds community. You know, that the community aspect there, that's really... you know, that's something that the recent Shakruna panel, they were talking a lot about, like how we can't forget, you know, in amidst all this focus on experience, that community, you know, actually being in community is a big part of all this too. Yeah, so that's just an example. Like, I'll look into this more. Maybe I'll reach out and see if I can figure out who this researcher is. But this is an example of, you know, I guess, you know, some people in a particular religious tradition. And I don't know about the particular researcher, but, you know, working with rabbis specific, you know, to, you know, meet them, help them, you know, figure out how to do this in a way that's going to resonate with the you know, their traditions and their practices and whatnot. And, you know, it's exciting. And I hope that we see all sorts of research with all sorts of different traditions, groups, practices, etc., you know. And I really liked in this example that, you know, was brought up in the five questions that, you know, we're seeing this, like, real engagement with the particular, you know, religious practice, community, tradition, you know. And I think that that's going to be a really important thing, you know, going forward in conducting research that's going to serve diverse needs, is like engage directly when developing the research with, you know, the communities that, you know, would benefit from it. And they live inside their religious world, you know, so they're able to speak for what the particular needs are going to be and like what the things are going to resonate more, you know.
Yeah.
So I just thought I'd bring him up. I thought that was a, you know, it's you know, there's people out there doing this work. I'm sure many, many more will appear, and I'm sure there's plenty that I'm just not aware of at all. But I just thought I'd share that from the microdose this morning.
That's a great example. That's an absolutely fantastic example based on, you know, our previous conversation around the need for changing these models and you know, what's not working about it. But I think the timing of that couldn't have been better.
Yeah, I love it when things work like that, you know?
Yeah, fantastic. So where do you want to pick up where we left off, or is there something you want to get started with?
Yeah, there. I just want to maybe add some a little more kind of clarifications and on the super placebo hypothesis, and you know, I'm talking about the inner processes.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, just, you know, I'll be fairly brief here. So, you know, I just want to mention, because I think I maybe stumble a little bit trying to find an example off the top of my head of a you know, a physical, or like what we think of as more of a physical sort of condition that psychedelics are, you know, being studied for. And I found a paper right after the recording that, you know, mentioned things like, and again, you know, we're what we call physical, but, you know, we're looking at, you know, like inflammation is something that they're looking at. Chronic pain, you know, everybody remembers cluster headaches. And then, of course, like, this is, you know, this could probably be considered a little more brain, but it's really, I think, speaks to the intersections of brain and mind and consciousness, but a phantom limb pain as well, or phantom pain. So, and then also I just wanted to say, like, so I used the phrase like inner processes or internal processes, all the time. And I want to clarify with that, because I don't want it to make it seem like I'm necessarily saying that, you know, it's all of what is occurring there, you know, like when people are tapping into this stuff, that's like completely just like it's just inside the mind, brain, body. Because, you know, thinking about, you know, say in like a, you know, shamanic practice where talking about spirits, you know, and engaging with these spirits, when I say that like that practice involves, you know, is harnessing these inner processes, you know, that on that practitioner of that practice, you know, probably, you know, they're gonna understand the spirit as being an external entity a lot of the time, like an actual autonomously existing being, and all, you know, things like energies and whatnot, you know. There's, so I just want to say that it's, when I say inner, like inner processes of change, there's two reasons for doing that. One is to, you know, kind of talk about, it's a process of the whole being, you know. By saying inner, you don't have to say, it's a little easier than saying like a process of the mind, brain, body complex or something.
Yeah.
And then also just, you know, it's, I'm saying inner as sort of like a useful sort of term. Like, I'm not making any sort of, you know, necessarily like a huge metaphysical claim, or I'm not trying to say that people are not tapping into things that are far bigger or external to themselves. It's more that kind of the it seems like the nexus, you know, the nexus. It's like where the healing is happening, or where the processes are kind of most, you know. It's, I mean, we're talking about a person, a whole person trying to alleviate some sort of condition. So, you know, it's sort of like a relatively speaking, like we're focusing on what's inside of that, like what's happening, these processes are happening inside them. But, you know, there could be, these could be processes that are far bigger than the individual person. Uh-huh. And so I don't want to, you know, I don't want to make it seem like I was making any really strong claims about, you know, what these processes are in terms of inner and external. Uh-huh. I'd also just add that, because so much of, the psychedelic research is focusing on, as I said, the, what we call like mental illnesses, you know? Yeah. And I just, I guess like a couple of things I want to say about that is, one, that just even the term like mental illness and the how it's distinguished from, say, physical illness, that in itself seems to be sort of a construction of you know, mind-body dualism and, like, you know, like we can mechanistically work on the body, you know, like, you know, study like proteins and stuff, but then with the mind, it's like this more amorphous interactive thing. So I think that, you know, other cultures, you know, might call the same, you know, like what we call, say, like post-traumatic stress disorder, they may call it something else and view it totally differently. And they might, you know, say, view the you know, the mind and the body and whatnot entirely differently. A colleague of mine, Sarah, we met, told me about how when she, I believe it was undergrad dissertation, she wrote about certain areas of Brazil. Kind of, she was drawing a comparison between what's called soul loss in certain shamanic traditions and post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, the pretty different model, talking about losing a piece of your soul and having to retrieve it versus, you know, like, you know, so there, with mental illness, like, and, you know, too, there's some anxiety sometimes, like, and I feel like in many people's experiences, this might be familiar, but, you know, something like, you know, look at something like an anxiety, you know, sometimes you might not feel it, you know, kind of in your mind quite as much, but then it manifests somatically, you know, like in some sort of tightness somewhere. And then, you know, sometimes a tightness or something, you know, say something that's coming from actual, like, stomach stuff, like thing, you know, like your digestive system to a certain extent, and then you get a clenching there, you know, that can then start feeding into, you know, your more psychological experience. It might, you know, then you get a kind of psychosomatic sort of anxiety loop going. And so my whole point here is that, you know, basically all these things that we call depression and you know, anxiety and post-traumatic stress disorder and stuff, you know, there are other ways to conceptualize them, and I suspect that a lot of times these conditions really are, that we can't really break them up so easily into, like, oh, it's a mental illness thing. It's like, you know, a ailment of the whole being that, you know, might in, say, a psychedelic treatment or a practice, you know, involve some visualizations where, say, things get removed from your spirit body or something like that. It's like, huh, I wonder what that's all about. If they're, you know, removing things from what in the visualization feels like the body in order to, you know, deal with what in our society we call mental health issues. It's like, huh, I wonder what's going on there, you know? So I just, you know, the point is, yeah, so like, focus on just mental health, like, kind of ignores the holism of the human being. You know, so I guess, like, so when we talk about, like, you know, current, you know, psychedelic research mainly focusing on mental illnesses, it's like we're saying that, you know, it's focusing on what we call mental illnesses, and that doesn't mean that they, you know, do not, you know, also involve what we would call the body or the, you know, the physical aspects, somatic aspects. You know. And then just one last thing from last little follow-up is, I just wanted to, just for all, you know, listeners, is I just want to stress that, you know, like, cause I was talking a lot about, you know, engaging with, beings and engaging with, psychedelic practices and engaging with non-medicated, you know, alternative practices that can get you to similar places. You know, I just want to stress the importance. If anybody out there is like, oh, like, I want to try that or something, or like, whether non-medicated or medicated or engaging with spirits in any context, it's like, it's really important to be guided, or you need some direction from somebody who knows what they're doing. There's, with psychedelics, you know, like, I spoke to a shamanic practitioner who doesn't practice with psychedelics, although this practitioner has had a lot of psychedelic experience, has kind of opened the door, it seems, for him. But he talks about how he will not say, like, he asks people, his students or whatever, to not say, you know, use these techniques and engage with these things in the same way, these dimensions, while taking psychedelics, because this shamanic practitioner, he doesn't have expertise in specifically working with psychedelics in this context. And he's like, so, you know, if you're gonna, you know, bring this very powerful substance into this, you should find someone who knows how to handle that. And it's, and, you know, as I said in the last episode, psychedelics, very powerful, have all these distinctive risks that non-medicated, you know, paths don't as much. But, you know, there's still, you know, especially if you're really going deep into things like other worlds and spirits and whatnot. You know, it's like Terence McKenna, he was talking largely about psychedelics, but I think the quote could be applied widely. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, mm-hmm. The schizophrenic drowns in the water in which the shaman swims, or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you're going in that water, even if you're not using psychedelics, it might be a good idea to have someone who can help you learn how to swim, you know? Because, mm-hmm. You know, that's all I just wanted to say. You know, it's like a kind of some fringe safety advice, I guess, or something. You know?
Fantastic. That was great. Well, thank you for all those updates. I think one of the things you mentioned was super placebo. Was there a specific example that maybe you want to bring up now?
Oh, yeah. I mentioned it like way at the very beginning. I was inflammation was one of the cases that like what we would think of as a physical ailment, mm-hmm. that is being looked at for psychedelic treatment. So, you know, that I think that's a, you know, I have to look a little bit more into all the specifics of any time a psychedelic is being used to treat a condition, but just, you know, that looks like probably one of the better examples of something that, you know, we very much like think of as like a, you know, relatively physical, but, you know, then again, you know, we know a lot about you know, inflammation being affected by all these complex factors. But, you know, I think it's good just with any, just to a good angle to think about, like the super placebo hypothesis, is just to remember a lot of these boundaries that we have drawn between physical, mental, mind and body, brain, mind, body, are, you know, may be limited, you know, those lines that we draw. And briefly mentioned stuff like cancer, mm-hmm. last time. And, you know, and I clarified, you know, it's like, remember Steve Jobs, you know, not talking about like replacing all this stuff, but, you know, it seems like, you know, a lot of times when you're recovering from or fighting some disease or even just staying healthy, so much of that is going to be these holistic processes, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, there's a lot that's almost just conventional wisdom about just having a good attitude when you're in the, you know, like stuff like that, you know, when you're trying to recover from just a cold or something like that. And, you know, everybody knows, speaking of recovery from colds, like, you know, everybody knows about, like emergency, you know, the super vitamin C stuff. It's like that they have not been able to show to reduce cold symptoms or any more than placebo. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, those trials are, you know, that like what they're doing there, it's like, you want to look into the specifics of the expectations of the researchers, but so many people go around buying it, mm-hmm. you know, and like, and swear by it, you know? And that's, I think that's like an example of, you know, one of these kind of like in everyday life sort of a, you know, the what we call a placebo effect being just used and people, you know, swear by it. So the super placebo hypothesis, we just want to really try to break down what, you know, those boundaries that we use in language and whatnot between mental and physical, and think about, like, you know, maybe times in one's own life where, you know, maybe you use emergency or whatever, or, you know, I don't know, like you go over to a family member's house and you start getting better, so, you know, some stuff like that, you know. Mm-hmm. That's sort of what we're tapping into, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, and then, oh man, I almost just ignored one little thing I wrote down about all of this mind, brain, body stuff connects back to, like, you know, I mentioned, like, you know, in, say, shamanic practices, taking things out of the body or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I just want to note that it's like a lot of practitioners from a wide range, really a wide range of traditions often talk about you know, things that we call like, you know, that are often called chakras or paths that energy travels like through. And like a lot of, you know, alternative, you know, healing modalities that don't involve psychedelics too, like involve working with things like chakras and energy. And, you know, I think that the concept of a chakra, I think, is an example of something that has arisen organically, spontaneously all over the place, and kind of speaks to this sort of place where mind and body are just one, you know, mm-hmm. And speaks to, and like the I think that anybody who's interested in all this, it'd be a, you know, could be interesting for them to you know, maybe if they don't have experience themselves with chakra stuff, for instance, like look at, you know, like read some accounts and like look into things like the phenomenology of what of chakra work and whatnot. Like, how do people describe their experiences when you know, they're engaging in some sort of healing or growth practice that involves the chakras? And I think that that might give a lot of pointers that could help make a lot of those make a little bit more sense if it doesn't already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. I'm so glad you came prepared with so much clarification and examples and just follow-ups on previous conversation. And I want to say, you know, anxiety as an example that you brought up, I think that's a great example of that sort of a super placebo effect. Because if you think about something like anxiety as an experience, you know, it could very well be a psychological anxiety or anxiety that's experienced mostly through in the mind or mentally, even though it's perhaps a reaction to something that's occurring in the body. Like maybe the body's uncomfortable for some reason, have had too much liquid or too much of this thing or this other thing. Mm-hmm. And that discomfort, because it's not being processed in any other way, it's being processed through this sort of mental way of experiencing things, and that ends up being anxiety. And conversely, you know, the other way around, there might be anxiety in the body for whatever reason, and that might not be mentally experienced in any way, or there's no mental reaction. It's all just in the body. That could be, I don't know, your stomach might be turning for long periods of time or something like that. And that's a really simple example, but I imagine with something like inflammation, you know, there are lots of things that could cause inflammation. And when we think about, and this is where I think it's super interesting what you've brought up, because when we think about psychedelics, introducing psychedelics to work with something like inflammation, I think it's possible that in some cases, the way in which that inflammation is healed or changed, could either be that the psychedelics are introducing an experience that's somehow causing the person to remove the thing that's causing the inflammation. So you're indirectly getting rid of the inflammation without really knowing that what you're doing is actually removing its cause. Or, you know, in another case, psychedelics could actually bring you closer to understanding what's causing the inflammation and having a sort of more direct awareness of that, and then, you know, causing that change that way. Or again, another case is what you were saying about the inner processes and inner workings and just kind of accelerating the finding of that pathway to get from inflammation to the removal of inflammation. Is all of that making sense?
Yeah. One thing that I'd say to that is there is an importance to say when we're looking at, you know, talking about like in a shamanic context, like removing stuff from the body, mm-hmm. or, you know, or like dismemberment or something, that's where like a spirit will like actually rip apart the body and put it back together, you know, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. A lot of, say, practitioners of these traditions would, you know, like there's different kinds of views as to like kind of how metaphorical, like that what's happening, say, in these visualizations is, I guess. Mm-hmm. So like, for instance, like, you know, one shamanic practitioner who, say, you know, merges with a helping spirit and, you know, removes some things from different parts of the of someone's body, that shamanic practitioner might see that as really being like directly removing the root cause of whatever is going on, whereas another might see it as like, this is happening like in the visualization, and it's like how, like it's like it's not necessarily like what it's like not necessarily like direct sort of a display of like the fundamental like causality, the processes that are going on there, like just because in the visualization like something gets removed part of the body might not necessarily mean that like there was something there. It's like the visualization could say be the meaning mediating like the way that that processes that are fought, that are really thought maybe beyond our understanding or can't really be represented to us consciously directly, it's like these visualizations and like experiences are sort of like a way that we can engage, we can like meet these processes or meet, you know, like whether inner or much larger, meet these processes with our human minds in a way that allows us to engage with them productively. So that is just one thing I would say in terms of, you know, been talking about like removing the cause and stuff. It's like, you know, different views, you know, if we finally get around to, you know, really like figuring out how to like do, you know, scientific research into this, you know, like in partnership with shamanic practitioners, you know, we could potentially actually learn more about what the, you know, what we can about the causality, what's going on there, you know?
Yeah, yeah, totally. And to tie this kind of back to that example that you showed up with today, the rabbi there, you know, if we don't look at, if we don't do enough research around actual causality and what's going on during these experiences, where, I mean, A, we're not learning as much, and B, we're basically dead. I mean, I frankly, I think that removing's not the word, but we're impeding the potential of what we can do with psychedelics, especially if we keep using those models, like the ones that you've brought up. Yeah, so let's go back to your research. So I think, you know, we've definitely heard quite a bit about your story around the research that you've done and how you got to that and what you've seen so far, conclusions you've drawn so far. Tell us more. Let's start with, because I think what we didn't do in the last conversation is give the listeners a bit of a history of ethics and psychedelic research itself, because we got the history of your research or how you got into it, but we don't really know about the bigger picture of ethics and psychedelic research use.
Yeah, so first I'd just say that, like, when we talk about the history of ethics and it's a huge topic. We're talking about the, you know, the history, because, you know, the history of psychedelic use is pretty long, you know, and, you know, involves you know, all these, you know, various, you know, indigenous traditions. You know, like, I haven't done enough research, nor am I the right person right now to speak to the history of how ethics have been handled in, you know, use Brazil 100 years ago or something like that, and a lot of times too, you know, like, it might be difficult to really kind of culturally translate sometimes, I guess, like, what like an ethics is from from one world to another. So I can mainly talk about the history of like the ethics, like sort of, I guess, starting with kind of like with the Western discovery of LSD and whatnot. So I'm mainly focused on like what we got to do right now, but I know a certain amount about the history. So basically, so like after LSD was discovered, you know, you had like Sandoz sending it out for free to all these researchers and you know, psychiatrists and whatnot, basically with the condition of, like, you know, you please tell us, you know, give us some data, like, tell us what the deal is. Sure. It's almost like they're kind of trying to crowdsource sort of like exploratory research or something like that. You know, in the research context, you know, let's just say that there weren't a lot of the same ethical constraints that we have today. Sometimes people both didn't know what they're getting into sometimes. Like, these are new drugs, and to say, like, you know, dose, you know, give people like very large doses while they're like, you know, in a really claustrophobic setting or something like that, you know, at a hospital somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, subject these people to some pretty gnarly suffering, you know. And so there's often this kind of I guess just like, I don't know, just attitude of just like, yeah, let's just, you know, like, not, I guess, like, you know, just exploring what these substances did without as much, you know, with a little bit too much gusto, you know, without being like, wait, what are we doing as people? Or like, what should we, you know, what should we kind of, what do we need to learn before and to make sure that, you know, when we do this, it's not going to hurt somebody or give them a horrible time, you know? And then of course, you know, we have like MK Ultra, you know, it's like, you know, that involved even, you know, dosing people without their consent or knowledge, you know, and then like horrible ethical, you know, violation there, you know, and violation of people's human rights. You know, and then naturalistic, like, scene that is like outside of the research laboratories, you know, like when like people, when you've had like, you know, the, like when you get, have the psychedelic counterculture starting to get rolling, there's also like, you know, there is a, you know, often an attitude there of this kind of evangelism with the LSD and this certain sense of you know, that like, this is, you know, people, any given person taking LSD is going to be good for them in the world. That was kind of seemed like a common sort of thought to the, you know, like, I mean, to the point where, you know, I've heard a number of stories, both from, you know, like older friends and family friends and et cetera. And, but then also, you know, you read books by like, you know, members of the Grateful Dead, and you will learn about a lot of non-consensual dosing going on in the 60s. Part of it too was enabled by LSD because it's so, you know, it's so unimaginably potent and colorless, tasteless, aromaless, you know. Jerry Garcia talked about, like, you know, there being LSD and like the frosting and some cake that people brought out and they didn't tell anybody. He's right. Like, yeah, I had a feeling that cake was dosed, but it looked really good. And I ate some anyway. So there was a lot, and all, you know, like both, you know, giving people, you know, dosing people without their knowledge or consent, thinking it'd be good, you know, and even like there's a famous story of a Grace Slick of Jefferson Airplane, who kind of in error due to her maiden name being listed instead, got invited to some event at the White House, like a Nixon event, and she like put, I think, 600 micrograms of LSD under her fingernail.
Oh my gosh.
Intended to go in there and dose Nixon, you know? So, you know, and it's like, you know, for whatever, you know, people's, you know, the reaction to the idea of dosing Nixon would be, you know, that's, no matter what, human being there, that would be, again, you know, without his informed consent, giving him that, and that's, you know, so it's like, you know, that's, you know, that story is kind of, has a lot of factors in it, but there's a lot of people thinking, like, that it's okay to just dose people, or to not, and then also not fully, a lot of times no one really knew what they were doing back then, like, the informed aspect, informed consent. You know, for example, like, a relative of mine, the first time he ever took any psychedelics was in it was in 1969 at the Altamont Festival, and he was up on the hill, like way far away from the stage where all the very, very gnarly stuff went down later on, so he missed all that, fortunately, but he was up there, and there's a guy walking around, as people did back then in the 60s, like with a bag full of tabs. He's like, here, you want one? He's like passing them around, you know, as people did, you know, that's, you know, that it shows that attitude of the, like, the evangelism and the kind of, like, yep. not really, you know, it's like just passing it around to strangers, you know? Right. And so my close relative, he's like, sure, I guess today is the day. And, you know, took the dose and described and had a great time. But he described to me, you know, like looking at like a tower with speakers on it mm-hmm. and seeing it fall over like something out of Lord of the Rings or something. And then looking back again, and it was just, it hadn't fallen. It was just there. Like, no, I'm like, whoa, that's a pretty, pretty intense hallucination right yeah. there. Like, that was a pretty fat dose, wasn't it? And he's like, yeah, it was. And, you know, there's a lot of other people I've spoken to who, you know, were, you know, taking acid and whatnot in the 60s, like, you know, and it's also just, there's, you know, there's a huge amount of evidence that basically the doses that were being handed around back then, just on average, were very large by today's standards. So it's like, you back then, you had people going around passing out, like, 400 microgram tabs to strangers in the park without really saying, giving them any sort of guidance or education or asking any questions about anything. Right. So, and, you know, that, of course, I think all of that probably, you know, fed into, you know, helped create some of the backlash, you know, you're going to get a lot, you know, both in the sense of, like, you know, more adverse effects happening, you know, people, you know, at festivals or wherever doing crazy things and hurting themselves, but also just, you know, from the perspective of, like, the status quo, I guess, it's like, it was probably pretty alarming, kind of reckless evangelism, I think, probably, you know, like, scared the status quo about stability of things, you know, which, and nowadays, you know, a lot has happened in, say, like, research ethics, you know, since the 60s, we put a lot more emphasis on informed consent now, and then also just in, you know, there's been so much work done, like, in, like, harm reduction education and whatnot, especially in more recent years, and also just like and in the context of like you know, like sexual relations, there's a lot more talk of consent, you know, and really serious discussions about that. So I think in the contemporary day, it's like we have things set up a lot better now for people to recognize the importance of informed consent with stuff like this. Although, you know, still there, you know, there's always, you know, like, there's still going to be some stuff going on, and, you know, like, in, you know, there's always going to be people who, for whatever reason, you know, don't think that that's necessary, you know, some for worse reasons, and some might be in good faith or with good intentions, others maybe not so much. And, you know, like, for example, you know, a good friend of mine a while ago was in a she's in a relationship with a man who he was very manipulative mm-hmm. and abusive in certain ways, and he cooked a lot of different drugs, like other research chemicals and stuff mm-hmm. and also had lots of dark room connections, and she told me a story of one time when this guy basically gave to some of her friends what they thought was cocaine, what he represented to them as cocaine. I'm not entirely sure. Maybe technically he didn't actually say it, but it was the whole account was this was very much understood to be cocaine, the substance that was being given to these individuals to snort. And as soon as they did, they started seeing a bunch of melty patterns in the sink. And they're like, wait, this is not cocaine. And it turned out it was 2CV. And the guy did that on purpose, you know? So there are still people around who will do stuff like that. One thing that was concerning to me, just too, about this particular individual is this is someone who... I found this out later, long after I heard that original story, but basically this individual had been planning to start, I don't know if he was waiting, I think he was intending to do it underground, and then potentially, and that maybe he was waiting for some sort of decriminalization situation or something, but basically he intended to, you know, open like an Ibogaine treatment condition, because I mean, I guess because he's, you know, involved in a very like a poly drug using community, so he knew a lot of people with addiction stuff, and he was intended to do it for addiction. You know, it's a complex figure, I suppose, but it just shows like some of those dangers out there. It's like we have a person who, you know, basically non-consensually gave people a drug that they did not think that they were using, you know, like, and then I have no idea where this individual is or what he's doing today, but, you know, this is someone who was then going to take it upon himself to start giving people Ibogaine treatment. You know, he was to be put himself in that role with that responsibility, and that's very concerning to me. So, you know, there are still, you know, there's still stuff like that going on, and it's something we got to watch out for and really protect people from. But fortunately, I think that there's just, as I said before, in our society, in our culture right now, there's a much, much greater than ever before kind of acknowledgement and respect for the need for fully informed consent. And I'd also say to just one sort of stream that I haven't exactly addressed yet in the history is in the underground guidance practices. So that's, you know, that's been going on, you know, underground for pretty long time. I mean, there's been a lot of semi-underground stuff, you know, with like Sasha Shulgin when he, you know, invented things like 2CB and when before MDMA became illegal, you know, you had sort of semi-underground stuff going on, and then when all those became fully illegal, it all went fully underground in the United States, Canada, and whatnot. And so, you know, so there's a tradition. There are many traditions like in this underground space that have been, you know, recognized over time, especially like they've, you know, started to recognize like just, you know, individuals and groups within that space. Recognize some of these ethical challenges, you know, start kind of both individually and as communities figuring out sort of guidelines for addressing them and navigating them with clients. That's probably in some ways a little, you know, unmoored in a certain sense, you know, because you've got people who are, you're in a very alternative space, let's say, if you're practicing underground guidance to a certain extent. I mean, you're doing something illegal. A lot of times underground guidance involves non-medicalized, kind of, you know, like alternative kinds of, you know, often sometimes shamanic approaches and whatnot. And so, you know, there's a wide variety of people with a wide variety of beliefs there and whatnot, but there has been over the decades a lot of very work being done by you know, communities in the underground space to develop, you know, ethical guidelines and share them and whatnot. And I think like nowadays, like as policy developments continue and as like interest in psychedelic guidance, you know, increases more and more, it's important to basically, you know, engage with the work and the knowledge that is that these underground practitioners have been cultivating over time, and, you know, synthesize that and work together with a lot of different perspectives and bring all of it together into ethical guidelines that we can all agree on and that are going to help keep people both safe and free and, you know, protect them from abuse from guides and whatnot. You know, and protect their human rights. Yeah, so it's like, you know, this is a time when there's a lot of streams kind of coming together to help us chart the way forward, you know? Just in research ethics too, nowadays it's like, compared to the 1960s, especially because, you know, this is the second wave, you know, you have to be, the scientists had to be much, much more careful, you know, in order to even get these studies, like, approved and funded and whatnot. So there's, you know, everybody's a lot more careful and informed about kind of traditional research ethics, you know, guidelines and whatnot that apply to just all human subject research. And we're not seeing people being dosed non-consensually in research or like strapped to a, you know, a bed in a hospital while given 1,000 micrograms of LSD or so, you know, that's not happening. And, you know, we have lots of protections for that and all these, you know, safety guidelines and whatnot for, and, you know, inclusion, exclusion criteria for those studies. But, you know, as I was talking about last episode is, you know, if, now that we're kind of acknowledging the suggestibility and super placebo aspect and how it's like, you know, in order to, you know, have, say, scientifically, be able to set, you know, have scientifically valid results, have the science, have, you know, the social value that it that is owed, you know. One of the bigger issues facing psychedelic research now, like ethical issues, is just the lack of engagement with all, with religious diversity, with all the potential alternative models, because there are ethical imperatives to, you know, shine a light on the truth and to shine a light on, to study things that, you know, have promised to have social value for everyone or for particular populations, you know? And so that, like, you know, as discussed last time, you know, there's a lot more, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be fixed in that regard. And I'd also just say that in research generally, this is both in research and just in guidance, I think that we need to really, really, really develop our informed consent processes, because I've looked at a number of informed consent documents for psychedelic research, and they still do seem very, very limited to me. We owe it to people to try our best to fully inform them of what could happen to and really, like, how far out they can go, you know, and also really how, you know, the suggestibility aspect and, like, and, you know, the freedom of thought, conscience, and religion aspect, you know, be like, you know, when you enter into this, you become more suggestible, you know, you will be incapacitated, like, you may have these very personally meaningful experiences, and these may be influenced by, you know, the expectations of your guide, or, you know, things of that nature, you know, so that, and, like, especially if you were, like, picking between, say, like, in the guidance context, like, you're picking between different guides to work with, for instance, I feel like when people are doing that, it's going to be really, really important for them to be fully informed of that, like, suggestibility and influence kind of aspect, you know, because you might, if you weren't aware of all this, like, if you thought that it kind of, like, you know, if you didn't understand kind of, like, how much, like, the guide and the container and the ritual protocol, whatever, can influence, the unfolding of your processes, you know, of your journey, you know, then you might, you know, not be as, you might not be as picky, I guess, with which guide you go to. You're like, oh, it's like they're just going to sit there while my thing unfolds, you know, or like they're, you know, but if you're conscious of the amount to which, like, you know, these influences can affect things, you know, you might pick a little bit, you might be a little bit more careful with picking a guide based on things like worldview resonance or personal characteristic, you know, whatever. But I think that that's really important.
Yeah, totally. I have to say, one of the things I really appreciate about these conversations with you is that you tend to answer questions before I even ask them. So I typically have a follow-up question, but you seem to go right into answering the follow-up question, which is great. So you've answered some questions there. I'm curious, just going back to ethical guidance, are there any, you know, organizations or associations, is there any body at all that's at least attempting to put together these, the guidance, you know, from maybe drawing from different things and putting together some sort of a template? Is there anything like that out there, or is that still pretty much a work in progress?
So I'm on the ethics team, the ethics working group for the American Psychedelic Practitioners Association. And we're actually, like, the working group, we're not the only ones who are working on this, but we are in our working group, basically trying to develop and refine a set of ethical guidelines for psychedelic practitioners, and bring together the different streams of the experiences and whatnot of everybody in the group. I can't really say a whole lot because I want to be careful not to, you know, respect everybody's privacy and whatnot. But yeah, we've got a team, and we're trying to develop some ethical guidelines that will work for people and will be used maybe in regulated contexts and maybe even put into regulations and into the law. And we're not the only ones doing this. I mean, there's this is probably a good way to say it is like a while ago when I interviewed Ryan Munavar, mm-hmm. who's the campaign manager for Decriminalize California. Mm-hmm. I was writing an essay on the California Psilocybin Initiative 2022. There's a section in that initiative that talked about legalizing psilocybin assisted therapy in the state of California. And it talked about basically like having an, I think they call it an independent certifying body or something like that, to basically like establish like the training requirements, licensing requirements, et cetera, regulatory guidelines or whatever for, you know, code of ethics, you know, for, you know, psychedelic therapy or psilocybin therapists in California. And Ryan I asked Ryan, I'm like, huh, like, so what's with this independent certifying body? Like how will that be established? Like how? And he said there's, you know, there's all these organizations out there that, you know, there'll be this scramble. He said the words he used, there'll be a scramble for proposals, mm-hmm. you know, if the, you know, the initiative went through, where he said different groups such as, you know, CIIS and MAPS, you know, mm-hmm. that would be kind of trying to get, you know, put forth different, you know, they'd want to be, you know, do the, you know, form the entire the certifying body, not just the code of ethics, but, you know, there'll be these different groups who, you know, have been doing, you know, working on ethical guidelines and other aspects of kind of preparing, you know, training for practitioners and whatnot. These groups would, you know, try to get their proposal selected by the state and, you know, get to start, you know, develop, you know, implement their particular ethical guidelines that they're developing. And then, of course, like in Oregon, you know, you've got a, you know, the Oregon Psilocybin Advisory Board, because they were tasked with basically setting up this whole, the whole framework for how psilocybin services would roll out over there. And so they've like, you know, developed ethical guidelines for and I wish I knew more a lot more about all of the Oregon developments, but it's hard. There's so much to pay attention to these days. But yeah, so they developed you know, they're, you know, have been working on ethical codes that'll be used by the facilitators. So there is work being done, and by a lot of different groups, and that's kind of what, and sort of with, you know, like with the ones that aren't already, you know, like with the Oregon Psilocybin Advisory Board, that's like the, you know, the law, the measure 109, like called for the, you know, the establishment of this group, and so they, like, you know, put it together and, you know, started the work. But in situations where there hasn't yet been some law passed that say calls for a group to be established, like that specifically would, you know, convene a group. The situation we're looking at is basically a number of different groups who are all, you know, working on their projects and hope, you know, kind of waiting for, you know, like policy developments and then hoping to kind of be taking the lead or giving input or whatever when say, you know, federal legalization happens or state legalization, you know. And it's like, because there's so much, there's just all this enthusiasm and interest and work being done, yet, you know, in the vast majority of jurisdictions, you know, psychedelics are still illegal, and we haven't act, you know, everybody's talking about, you know, legalization and psychedelic medicine, but we're not actually there yet, you know. So that means that you have, you know, all these groups of all these people who are really excited and passionate about all this, waiting for the government, you know, kind of like working this all out, and then, you know, then later on we'll see how all the everybody's projects will end up actually, you know, entering into the world and in given the policy mm-hmm. development.
Yeah. I could listen to you for long periods of time. Long periods of time. So you're welcome to keep going.
Okay. Yeah, I guess, like, I wanted to basically bring up an Ibogaine story that I, you know, I mentioned Ibogaine earlier, you know, with the individual who had given people 2CV without their consent and wanted to open, you know, Ibogaine clinic, I believe underground at the time, maybe waiting for legalization or decriminalization of some kind. I basically want to, so this story that I'm going to tell, so I interviewed the person who told me this story just last week. The story is about informed consent, and it's also about just like general kind of like safety and ethics issues, and it's about Ibogaine specific issues, physiological ones and physiological risks, that is, and also just I'll just tell it, and then all the implications will fall out. So this individual, he had taken LSD a couple times in the 60s, had a good time, and hadn't in a long time. And then he when he was a much older man, I think it was maybe about 8 years ago, he said, he had gotten cancer ended up finding an underground LSD practitioner, to kind of, do an exploratory, kind of like an, end of life, coming to terms with things. Right. It wasn't like he was diagnosed terminal or anything yet, so he did this practice, and then he liked there's some things he didn't like, but he liked the therapist, the guide, it was a really, really meaningful experience. And he said it was life changing experience, a marriage changing experience, in very positive ways. And then not long after this, I didn't write down exactly how long, but I believe it was within the same year. The therapist who had given him the, done the LSD session contacted my interviewee. We'll call him Steve. So he contacted Steve saying, "Hey, I'm going to be doing this Iboga group ceremony." Steve said, he's like, "Oh, what the heck, he liked the therapist guy, and he still had cancer and whatnot." He's like, "Okay." And, he mentioned, Steve mentioned, he said that at this time he had like had a bunch of surgery, and he used the phrase, he had weird innards. for example, had surgery, which is, removed his esophagus and moved stuff around. So a lot of some health conditions going on. And he still had the cancer. And he said he had, at this point, I think he said he'd been given a 20% chance to live. He very much, especially after the really transformative LSD session, he's like, and he's still, still potentially facing death here. He's like, "Okay, let's do this." This is a really, really crucial little step of the story. So he asked the therapist, because he had some reservations. He's like, "I have all these health issues and whatnot." And he said, Steve said he really does not like throwing up. Like, that can really mess with him a lot. And so he's like, "Huh." So he asked the therapist, "Is this going to be safe for me?" And the therapist said, "Yes, absolutely." So Steve went to this group ceremony, and he said, this is what he said. He said to me, Steve made one mistake that later especially stuck out. He said, he said the wrong thing cosmically, or thought the wrong thing. He thought, "This is going to be fun." I guess he feels that Steve feels that thought may have, had a role in the what followed. But so he goes into the room. It's like a teepee kind of situation, and he can't lie flat because of the lack of esophagus. There's like acid reflux stuff, so he uses a wedge pillow. So there's 8 people in the teepee with the therapist there, And they all go around and, you know, eat the root. You know, the therapist, you know, instructs at the beginning, says, you know, raise your hand if you need anything. But then this is another huge, like, what the heck kind of thing. And, you know, especially with Ibogaine, as we'll get to, the therapist at a certain point, like fairly early on, it sounded like in the ceremony, he leaves the room. He straight up leaves this group of people who are on Ibogaine, just leaves the room inexplicably. And so I think, you know, before he left, he checked in with Steve and said something about, like, oh, I can feel or see the iboga is coming out of your chest. You're good. And then, you know, leaves. So when the therapist is gone, Steve, you know, like, kind of the, you know, nothing's happening. And then you know, it sounds like stuff, you know, affects are kind of starting to hit at this point. And he has to go to the bathroom. And the bathroom is outside, and he couldn't raise his hand if he needed something because the therapist was gone. And so Steve, like, you know, eventually goes out and tries to, because the bathroom's outside, he tries to find it. And it's like, he couldn't find it. Ibogaine is really starting to hit, and he's getting really confused, and, you know, just overwhelmed. And he eventually kind of makes his way. He is able to find the bathroom or find sort of where it is. And he's feeling really horrible, and he's crawling on the ground. Like, he's in the effects are really strong. He crawls to try and find the bathroom, crawls back. And then when he comes back, he can't find a seat, you know? And he's like, so, yeah. And because he had that wedge pillow. And I think, to me, this sounds, there's a lot of interpersonal social kind of consciousness that, you know, like, you know, you're like finding your space where you're not infringing on someone else's space, you know? Which, you know, that kind of stuff could be difficult to navigate when you're under the influence of Ibogaine. So, and eventually when he's crawling back to find a seat, he, like, falls on this other guy, and the other guy helps him. You know, he's not the therapist. And the other guy, Steve told me that the other guy later on said, like, I'm sorry, I couldn't help you more. I was really far out myself. You know, that's why we have supervision, you know, like, you know, overall, just, you know, had this, like, really kind of traumatic in many different ways experience. And he said, Steve told me, he's like, he says what he thinks the two biggest mistakes of the therapist or, you know, aside from, I mean, this is what he said. I would add, like, you know, that was not informed consent at all. But what Steve said is that the therapist, he didn't take blood pressure at all. And, you know, and he also left. And then I would add to, you know, he left them unsupervised. I would, you know, add to the blood pressure thing, in addition to adding the more informed consent, is he didn't screen, he didn't really, you know, address the kind of, like, pre-existing health issues aspect here. He's like, yeah, you'll be fine. And so Steve, the next day after this Ibogaine session, he said he could hardly drive. He had all his head fuzz, he called it, really unsteady, kind of trembling, and it stayed like that for a while. And then he just, he's had all of these kind of health issues that basically seem to him to have arisen, you know, over time, not like immediately, like clear causality, but especially, like, you know, with the right after the head fuzz stuff. Basically, he's had a lot of health issues that strongly suspects came from that Ibogaine session. Like, right now, Steve wears a heart monitor, which he did not have to before. And he told me a story of going to a play, like, with his wife, like four years after this Ibogaine thing. And he said there was this very strange little kind of episode where he physically couldn't talk, and, like, his wife, you know, like, says, you know, like, yeah, I could see he was, like, trying to, and so it lasted about a minute or two, and Steve said it felt like half an hour, and it says, you know, it's clear that he was trying to say stuff, and eventually he did. This is strange. Eventually he was able to get something out before the episode, kind of at the end of the episode. He said, I can't let angels be my competition. He has no idea what that means, He has no idea what that means. Funny stuff appears sometimes, but he had the impression, he's like, was this some like miniature stroke kind of thing? And then later on, when he like went to the doctor, I believe this is somewhat later, the doctor looked at his brain and said that he had had at least one mini stroke at some point. And so now Steve is, you know, he's like waiting. I think he's getting more, like he's getting more heart checked, EKGs, EEGs, blood work, etc. And he's, you know, he's seeing different doctors to figure things out, you know, figure out what's going on. And he also noted he did not have a, you know, heart, like there isn't a history of heart stuff in his family, which he thinks is a little suspicious. And so that's like that's basically the overall of the story here. And so I just want to kind of unpack some of these, you know, the implications here, is why I'm bringing this up. So, you know, obviously
that was definitely not informed consent, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely not. That's like, I mean, because it's that informed consent is like, first of all, I mean, Steve shouldn't have had to even ask, like, is this going to be safe for me? That responsibility to, like, you know, you, like, if you are someone who is, administering, you know, presiding over, you know, sessions with these, with all, any of these substances, you know, it's like your responsibility is to, you know, learn everything there is to, that you can about the risks and whatnot, and especially for, you know, medical contraindications and whatnot. You gotta learn about that, and you gotta tell prospective patients, clients about that, and you gotta, it's your responsibility too, to, given what you know about both the treatment and the individual who is in front of you, you know, they have some particular health condition, you have to, like, you got to screen, you got to make sure that you're not about to give somebody something that's going to hurt them because of, say, conditions they have already or whatever. And so that just, you know, that didn't happen. It's like, it's like Steve had asked, is this going to be safe for me? And the therapist just says, yes, you know? I imagine, like, if, say, that the therapist guy, like, you know, planned on just like, oh yeah, like I'll kind of leave like whenever I feel like it or whatever. you know, if it was fully 4%, he'd have to say that in there, you know, like there might be a time when I leave all of you alone in the room without any sober, you know, it's like, then, you know, maybe Steve would have been like, hey, wait a second, you know? And then that of course leads to, you know, like as Steve mentioned, one of the other big problems, like leaving then without the supervision, you know, it's like, that was such that's the kind of thing that like pretty, I've not seen any sort of any guidelines, ethical guidelines, safety guidelines that do not say you can't leave them alone. You know, it's like you can't leave. Someone's got to be there with them. Stuff could have gone so bad, you know, especially in a group with the kind of dynamics that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, and then, you know, this is so both the, so just in general, like the informed consent issue, you know, like the lack of informed consent there and the lack of really, like, you know, the therapist conducting himself safely and really, like, you know, upholding his obligations to care for these individuals. It really shows how it's the importance of ethical guidelines, you know, and the importance of basically, like, how do we, you know, sit and, like, because say this is in the underground, right? So, you know, even if, say, like, you know, we have more and more you know, situations like Oregon and whatnot, where you have regulations to, and like licensing systems to protect people, you know, from stuff like this, you know, there's always going to be some sort of underground, I think, no matter what happens, just even, maybe even just because there'll be, you know, there's demand might exceed regulated supply or whatever for therapist hours, whatever. So there's always gonna be underground. So it's like, if there's questions too, it's like, you know, in a regulated system, it's like no one would ever be able to conduct themselves like this. But, you know, there will be these dangers in the underground continuing on. And we need to figure out how to, you know, because how do you protect people in like when everybody's kind of operating outside of the law, you know, like, and I think, of course, as I said last time, education is a huge one. I think that you know, I mean, I can't really get too into all it because it's like a whole other big topic. Like, how do you ensure ethics and safety in the underground? But you know, I think it just shows it's like there are serious and like there are. This is a very experienced person who had like degrees. So I believe he was a licensed therapist who did all this. Uh-huh. And it's like, you know, he seemed pretty confident in himself. And, you know, like we, you know, this is stuff we, especially when people are dealing with these powerful substances and dealing with like spiritual stuff, it's like they can get some odd ideas and maybe kind of overestimate certain things or underestimate others. So, you know, there's a lot of room for improvement and a lot of room, and like there's a lot of dangers there. And then what I also wanted, the other kind of reason that reason I brought this up and the sort of implication is that both in terms of ethical guidelines, safety measures, and like really informed consent and screening as well, it's important to be substance specific to when needed. So like what I mean by that is that like, you know, psilocybin has you know, like affects people differently and has different risks for different people than MDMA. And both of them have different, you know, different safety profiles, different effects than ibogaine, you know? And, you know, we can't, and so like when we're, you know, trying to protect people, keep them safe, you know, with ethical guidelines, safety measures, you know, informed consent processes, we have to acknowledge the differences with these different substances and, you know, not pretend that they're all just psychedelics and they're just all the same or whatever. And so with ibogaine, you know, there's like this is a substance that, you know, it appears to present some physiological risks that especially for basically like people with pre-existing health conditions and then, you know, like people who, you know, because a lot of people you seek ibogaine treatment for addiction, you know, like people are using certain drugs and, you know, kind of run a number on their hearts and whatnot, you know, poly drug users, that, you know, those kinds of, you know, conditions can also make it more dangerous, you know, and it's, you know, in ibogaine treatments where they, you know, where they're really doing things, you know, safely, they're usually hooking people up to cardiac, they're screening people, of course, but they're hooking people up to cardiac monitoring devices a lot of the time. Uh-huh. And they'll usually do like a full medical checkup with, you know, like with heart rate and pulse and everything beforehand. It's like you need, there's medical staff there, you know, there's like emergency, you know, resources there. And it's like, that's not real. This just isn't, from what we know. And there's always room for surprises, but this is not the case with psilocybin, you know, it's like, you know, we gotta recognize it's like, okay, say we're putting out ethical safety guidelines or whatever, or we're putting out like a model informed consent document. It's like, it's really important to like, you know, like people, it's basically like people who are administering ibogaine have, you know, certain, you know, just, it, I mean, everybody, all these caregivers have the obligation to, you know, act in the best interest, the safe, you know, preserve the safety of the patient, the client. But it's like, you know, with ibogaine, those obligations like are involved, they demand things like have it because of the particularities of the substance, they demand having, you know, these extra particular safety measures for these physiological risks, you know? And it's like, if we look back at, you know, Steve's story, it's like, you know, he mentioned that, you know, the therapist didn't take his blood pressure and didn't really, you know, ask him about or engage with his he had all the surgery, cancer, all that, you know, he didn't, you know, really just even go there at all. And, you know, so it's, so basically it's like this therapist really, really did not uphold his obligations. And, you know, we don't like, We don't know if Steve's current like health conditions and like needing to have the heart monitor. We don't know whether or not that has anything to do with the Ibogaine. We don't, but it might, you know. And it's like we're looking at, you know, a session that was run without any screening or anything with the guy, leaving, and it's you. Who knows? And it's like, you know, it's especially say that at least some of his health issues did come from that, you know, poorly run Ibogaine, session. Let's think about how it's like the kind of issues seem to take a good amount of time to really manifest. So it's like, say even if we're like studying Ibogaine, the safety or looking at what the proper safety measures should be with patients who receive the treatment, like how long we need to follow up for, you know, it's like, it's a thing in all psychedelic research. I think we need to do much, much, much more long-term follow-up with everybody, because say that Steve's health conditions did come from the Ibogaine, say that this is something that happens. It's like, there could be these like longer term or like longer to manifest adverse effects that occur sometimes, and we would just miss them, you know, if we just do really short follow-ups, you know. And just one thing too, I'd say, like, I have the abstract of paper in front of me called "Fatalities After Taking Ibogaine and Addiction Treatment Could Be Related to Sudden Cardiac Death Caused by Autonomic Dysfunction." And there was this one little line that stuck out. And again, this paper is, you know, is focusing on addiction treatment with Ibogaine, but they say we hypothesize that these deaths may be a result of cardiac arrhythmias caused by dysregulation of the autonomic nervous system. Ibogaine affects the autonomic nervous system by influencing several neurotransmitter systems in the fastigial nucleus, etc. And so I'm just looking at that like, huh, cardiac arrhythmia is caused by a dysregulation of the autonomic nervous system. So I'm thinking about just like both like, just, you know, there's a lot we don't know about, you know, all these substances, but I'm thinking about super placebo stuff again here, where it's like, that paper is like talking about, like, they're talking about like, you know, dysregulation of the nervous system. It's like, I'm like, that sounds a little bit suspiciously like the sort of zone, like the, you know, like whole, you know, like regulation of the nervous system that then affects, you know, the heart and whatnot. That kind of seems like suspiciously like maybe it's the sort of zone. It's kind of gesturing at the sort of zone where if your inner processes were not directed in a healthy, safe way. These inner processes, you know, it's like we talk about the nocebo, the placebo, there's also the nocebo. It's like the, you know, like when bad things happen to you. So it's like, I'm just thinking, it's like this man, Steve, he's like freaking out and crawling around and stuff in this unsupervised context. You know, it's like he's not, it's like, so what's going on in his whole being, his inner processes, mind, brain, body complex? It's like, it's not a good setting for channeling that in a positive way. And it sounds like it got kind of messed up. Like he was in this imbalanced, upset, kind of confused, and his body felt physical feelings, and like, you know, I just have this like, I'm like, I wonder if, you know, like, say that these health issues did come from the Ibogaine. Maybe they wouldn't have, or they would have been less. They wouldn't have been anywhere near as bad if, say, the therapist knew what he was doing and didn't like just leave this room full of people to their, you know, to just, you know, and he didn't like descend into this really gnarly sort of space, you know. So I'm like, maybe his inner processes got a little messed up from basically like tapping into this dimension of self with a psychedelic that also has physiological effects. You know, it talks about, maybe all that came together and messed him up. And so, you know, it's like, you know, it's it just shows how important it is for us to like study all of this like honestly and like, you know, rigorously in order to keep people safe. And like even the follow-up after long-term follow-ups and stuff, like we did not even to the level of super placebo yet, but you know, even if we weren't even thinking about the super placebo aspect or super nocebo aspect, who knows in this case, but you know, it's like, just because Ibogaine's got these, you know, physiological risks, it appears, and like, you know, maybe Steve's symptoms came from that, maybe so, maybe not. But you know, it's, we got to learn a lot more about this in order to, you know, and even just like say with like underground practitioners or something, say, you know, there's no way we could, you know, stop them or whatever. You know, I have to be like, you know, education again, maybe like, you know, make it like, because right now I think a lot of people might kind of lump Ibogaine in with say like mushrooms and cacti or something, you know? And it's like, we want to educate people about like, you know, this is, you know, like this is, it's a little different. There are these, you know, like you've got maybe see, if you're trying to go to an underground practitioner, you should see your doctor first or so, you know, something like that, you know? It's like education. Yeah.
My God, that was an incredible story, and you know, incredible because of what it offers us in terms of confirming the importance of just more research, more learning, and way more ethical practice standards and guidelines, so that people like this therapist or practitioner aren't just, you know, inviting people to come in and ingest a drug that has psychedelic effects and then just kind of leaves them to their own devices. Because that kind of thing could be avoided. And with that, a lot of the effects that come, you know, as a result. What an incredible story. There was something that you mentioned at the end there that, just education going back. I think you had mentioned in the previous conversation how important education is. And again, this story really serves to prove that. Had that practitioner been more educated, or maybe, you know, the practitioner was more educated in the matter and simply didn't care. But let's assume that he just didn't know about the effects and didn't know about the physiological effects in particular. And, you know, Steve as well, also maybe was not educated enough to understand what he was getting into. So education, very important, informed consent, very important. It, overall, really just more research, not just research, but, a more eclectic approach to research in psychedelic use is necessary. This has been another incredible sort of second part to our conversation. I'm curious to know if you have any thoughts that you would like to end this conversation with and leave our listeners with.
I guess I would just emphasize the just education, you know? And just shining, like, you know, shining light on everything, you know, just we need to, with honesty and with just like goodwill towards humanity and respect for other human beings, like we need to make sure that everybody has the tools to navigate the space as best they can and understands what they're getting into, you know, if they do choose to get into something, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll just throw being objective in there as well. Objectivity is also very important. Especially when we're teaching other people things or trying to discover
absolutely
more about something. It's good to be objective. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Joseph. What another incredible conversation. You know, as far as I'm concerned, you're welcome to come back maybe for season three, because you've got a lot to share. And I personally really appreciate the perspectives that you've got to offer.
Glad to be able to, you know, just talk about these things, and so that, you know, education, you know, and also, you know, speculations to like super placebo and whatnot, you know, it's like, it's still a hypothesis. I think it's probably true, but you know, some speculations, yeah. And then, you know, education, I guess, you know, learning about speculative hypotheses that affect, you know, if they are true, strongly affect, you know, the practices, the experiences, what, you know, the whole space, you know, even if it's speculative, it's still learning about it. It's still important education, if you ask me.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Well, we'll leave it at that note. Thanks again. And we'll see you next time.